Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassin here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll settle down and have a chat with a man with a purpose. Marcus Bukonin traveled 8 years across the globe without using a single motor. No planes, no motorboats or motorcycles. You might have heard of him already on Viewpoints, as we did play an excerpt from an interview he granted to Owen Thompson. But today, we'll have the whole story.
You know, for the first few years of the journey, I would have nightmares that I would wake up in a motor. This vehicle. They weren't frequent nightmares, but common enough that it was concerning, because I obviously could not let go of the fear of, you know, messing up my mission. And I always, and one of my biggest concerns was that bureaucracy somewhere along the way would force me into a vehicle just because they can. I always felt way safer in the middle of the ocean on a sailboat than I did on highways, because when I'm out there, my life is in my own hands and I'm quite comfortable and confident that I can hold on to the boat. It can be very scary. I'm not gonna, you know, most of my fear in sailing across the oceans came from just getting in and out of harbors and ports.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for being with us. Recently, Tom Jorn Petersen, a man from Denmark, traveled across the world for 10 years without hopping on a plane. Well, here's somebody who took the concept even further. Canadian Marcus Bukonin finished his 8 years and 70,000 kilometer global adventure using no motors at all. Boats, planes, motorcycles, nothing. He did it this way to keep his CO2 emissions to a minimum. Bukonin has finally arrived back home in Canada, where his journey started. He has sailed through the Pacific, Indian, and Atlantic Oceans. He has biked across many countries and mountains, and he has even done some of his journey on a pogo stick. Bukonin is the founder of the nonprofit society Roots of Change. The goal of his odyssey and of the organization was and still is to promote sustainable travel while making you aware of the impact you have on the world. His journey ended in Toronto on the 8th of July, where he attended a walkathon, exactly where he started 8 years earlier. Journalist Owen Thompson, based in Toronto, Ontario, spends the next 25 minutes or so talking with Marcus Bukonin about his journey.
From the start of your journey to the end of your journey, what has been the, I guess, biggest change for you personally?
Oh, that's a tough question to answer, and I don't know really the answer to that one. I guess the biggest change is that I'm 8 years older. I don't feel like a 30-year-old anymore.
What made you want to go on this voyage, and the way you've done it, especially?
I came up with the idea when I was fighting forest fires in British Columbia, and I had done that work for a number of years. I had actually worked seasonally in British Columbia, and then I would travel down to Central and South America, where I could live quite comfortably on a small budget. And, you know, I started seeing how my purchase choices in Canada and just my life in Canada were affecting communities all over the world. There's a number of different things that influenced me. I was just sort of attempting to be more of the change that I wanted to see in the world, like Gandhi. but I got to a point where I didn't feel like that was enough. And part of my inspiration came from reading this book actually called Blessed Unrest. And it just inspired me to know that there were people all over the world who were not giving up on our species and the health of this planet. And it inspired me to get more involved in environmental and social activism. But at the same time, I had no interest in working in an office doing that sort of work. And so I basically was figuring out how I could combine what I am passionate about and create my dream job. It was right at that time, at the end of a fire season, that my dad called me up and said, he had 2 weeks to live. If he didn't do some serious chemo, he would die. On my way home to see him on a plane, the irony is not lost on me. I formulated this Roots of Change plan, and it was basically came from the question, what would I want to be doing with my life if I found out that I was going to die in 2 weeks? How could I be living my life with no regrets? The Roots of Change project was my answer to that question. And my dad ended up surviving another 6 months, but then passed. Right before he passed, he was able to meet my niece, who had been born 2 weeks before. My other sister had also just become sober after a long battle with drugs and alcohol. And all of these things combined just made me think about my impact on the future and what I was doing with my life. And so I just sort of started working towards this dream of mine, went back to school for documentary filmmaking and started looking for a budget for a film, because that's how I figured I would make this into my job and make a film out of it and get a budget that way. But that did not come easily. And eventually it wasn't until 7 years later that I finally grew up the courage to just start the journey with very little financial backing and support. Yeah, I just went for it. Hoped it would work out.
Why zero emissions? Why no motors?
Well, so I wanted to, as part of the main mission of the journey, is to highlight and raise support for other local non-governmental grassroots environmental and social justice organizations. And in doing that, I mean, often their battles are against these big corporations, often oil and gas corporations, who are destroying their land and their environment. And so I figured I should, you know, I limit my support of these corporations in doing what I do. Instead of flying around the world or taking helicopters around the world, I figured I would just draw my line of support in the sand at that point and just not use motors. Of course, I'm not blind to the fact that much of our world functions in some way thanks to motors, but I think we have an exaggerated view of how we need to rely on them. I think we've forgotten that it wasn't long ago that we survived quite happily and healthily without them. I also just really love a good adventure, and I really love being athletic outdoors. And so that mission of not using motors lends itself very well to what I'm also passionate about. And yeah. And I figured, you know, if I do something big and crazy, big challenge, I should be able to find the support to make it happen and be able to get some attention to support these other organizations.
After, I guess, 8 years of motorless transportation, what's the hardest part about it, about doing that?
You know, the hardest part is the fact that the world is no longer designed to move around without motors. Highways and roads and border crossings and bureaucracy are all sort of up against me. I you know, for the first few years of the journey, I would have nightmares that I would wake up in a motorized vehicle. They weren't frequent nightmares, but common enough that it was concerning, because I obviously could not let go of the fear of, you know, messing up my mission. And I always, one of my biggest concerns was that bureaucracy somewhere along the way would force me into a vehicle just because they can, and they like to use their power to express their, you know, their dominance over you at times. But that never happened, thankfully. I did have a lot of challenges at border crossings. Of course, I'm doing something that these people who have the power to say no would prefer to say no, as opposed to feel responsible for the death of a foreigner in their territory. But thankfully, I had a friend who was, right before I started the journey, he was elected to as a member of parliament, and he wrote me a letter that sort of helped to soothe government's concerns around the world. It was sort of like my get out of jail free card. I never did get in jail, but it did help me cross borders here and there. Basically said that I was not just some crazy lunatic out on a mission to kill himself. I actually had a purpose and the support of my community back home, and basically put the responsibility less on these people and more on my own government and my own community. So So that was nice to have. But yeah, I mean, one of the hardest things was definitely just cycling on the roads. I always had to sort of accept that my death was very close when I was on a road or a highway. In addition to that, Asia was quite depressing with the amount of pollution, not even just in the highways, but when you get into the mountains in the Himalayas, there's still smog up there because of all the industry in India.
You left North America in 2016, just checking the map here. Yeah, April 23rd, 2016. Getting across the ocean motorless seems a little difficult. So how exactly did you go about that?
Well, yeah, when I first started the trip, I didn't know how I was going to get across the ocean. I figured I would crew on a sailboat or something like that. And then a few weeks into the trip, back in July of, or I guess it was August of 2015, a friend of a friend called me up and said he was up for sailing with me to Hawaii. He had a 30-foot boat and he needed some help getting to Hawaii. So I met him in San Francisco about 9 months later, and we sailed together as a 25-day sail to Hawaii from San Francisco. And then he lent me the boat and I sailed it solo the rest of the way, most of the rest of the way across the Pacific Ocean. You know, sailing, I always felt way safer in the middle of the ocean on a sailboat than I did on highways, because when I'm out there, my life is in my own hands and I'm quite comfortable and confident that I can hold on to the boat. It can be very scary. I'm not going to, you know, lay that down. It can be extremely scary, but in the end, as long as you hold on, like, most of these boats are designed to weather hurricanes, and I never even came close to weathering a hurricane. Most of my fear in sailing across the oceans came from just getting in and out of harbors and ports and close to land, because I wasn't using a motor. These harbors and these ports are not necessarily designed for people who are not using motors anymore. I had to be really safe and really patient and just get as much local knowledge as possible, but it was always a bit scary, and that caused most of my stress and anxiety in regards to sailing.
How many nautical miles did you sail overall?
I believe it was around 23,000 nautical miles. Yeah, so that first boat, I gave it back to the owner in Hong Kong, and then I was mostly on bicycle, but a few other kayak boats and random fishing boats through Asia. I got stuck in COVID in India, and then eventually got a 27-foot boat to myself in the south of India, and I sailed that across the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean.
So in your journey, I guess, what has is there a specific locale that kind of you look back on as one of the most beautiful settings you've ever seen?
Before this journey, I was living in Tofino, and I started the trip in Toronto and then made my west across Canada back to Tofino. And having been around the world, there's actually nowhere in the world that I would rather live. I love Tofino, and that's probably one of the most beautiful places I've been. Outside of that, Hawaii was a very pleasant surprise. When I first landed on the Big Island of Hawaii, the energy of that place was just magical. It really is the land of rainbows. There's always rainbows, and they have an interesting array of climates because of the giant volcanoes. You can get snow up on the volcanoes, and it was a pretty special place. And then, yeah, sailing through Micronesia was for sure one of the more beautiful places I've been on the world, but I was not of great health, so it wasn't as magical for me. I was suffering from this flesh-eating bacteria that sort of migrated through my system and took a few months for it to finally heal. Northern Vietnam was really magical for me, but a lot of these places, they're so beautiful, but what really makes them is the people. You know, you can find beautiful places all over the world, but it's the people that you meet that really, for me, define a country and a place. And thankfully, it seems like in every single country I've been to, I've met wonderful people who have just opened up their doors and their hearts and welcomed me like family. So
how was there any difficulty with language barriers and communication?
100%. Yeah, language barriers in Asia are pretty challenging, although, you know, there's pretty much in every town now somebody speaks English, or at least a few words in English, so you can get by. But also with these apps, you know, Google Translate and these other apps, you can sort of get by and have conversations with that help. But I also, in every country I went to, I at least attempted to learn basic conversations, you know, how to ask for water and food and say thank you and hello, my name is. And so I'd say I learned how to do that in, I don't know, at least eight languages. I don't remember them now, but it's challenging in Asia because there's small countries. They often only give you a 30-day visa. And then you're in a new country and that country's speaking a completely different language. Whereas I had traveled a lot in South and Central America previous to this trip. And, you know, it's pretty much all Spanish. So you learn Spanish, which is an easy language to learn, and you can communicate with, you know, the vast majority of the people there. Even in India, like, you know, it's this giant country and people will think that, you know, most people speak Hindi or English, but there's, you know, hundreds of different languages, and it's not easy.
Bringing back to India, actually, you said you were stuck in India due to COVID. How long were you there for?
I was in India over a year, almost a year and a half in total, including the time that I went into Nepal in between. My first lockdown, I actually was locked down in the north of India in a town called Rishikesh. And 2 days before the COVID lockdown, I met a girl. So it was actually pretty wonderful timing. I was already planning on going up to an ashram and doing some yoga and meditating and editing videos for the YouTube vlog. I wasn't able to get up into the mountains. I was, instead I was stuck in this town called Rishikesh, which actually is famous all over the world for yoga teacher training, and as the place where the Beatles went to their ashram in India. It's a pretty wonderful place. It's right where the Ganges comes out of the Himalaya mountains. And, there was a community of peaceful yogis from all over the world there to spend the first 8 months of COVID with. So it was actually, you know, it was this pretty lovely experience for me. And it was a much more social time than I was used to quite a while on the journey. So, and then also thanks to COVID, I was able to find my sailboat because an Australian, young 21 year old, I think, had sailed the boat from England and arrived in India just as COVID hit, gone home to Australia. And so his boat was just racking up expenses sitting at a marina, and he was happy to sell it to me for quite cheap. And that's how I managed to, when the first lockdown lifted up, I think it was like a 3,000 kilometer bicycle through COVID in the middle of, or through India in the middle of COVID, and got to the boat, spent 4 months fixing it up, working on it, and then sailed away right before the like sort of more serious second wave hit India. From there, I sort of just lucked out with the countries I went to. Seychelles had no restrictions because they were the most vaccinated country in the world. Tanzania was the next country I went to, and their president had denied the existence of it altogether. And then South Africa, they were completely relaxed about it and welcoming also. So that sort of got me close towards the end of the COVID times.
Yeah, you touched on it there for a second. How lonely is it to travel the world by yourself?
You know, I haven't always been by myself. I have had friends join me for parts of the journey, and I'm actually very comfortable being alone, especially when I'm, you know, planning to go out to sea and be alone. I'm prepared for it, mentally prepared for it, and quite capable at entertaining myself. And I do have some entertainment out there. I can read books and listen to audiobooks, listen to music and stuff. And I'm comfortable just staring at the ocean. But
let me rephrase the question a little. I guess, how isolating is it?
Isolating? I'm sure that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think it depends from country to country. You know, the times when I feel the most lonely is when I get into a city and people don't recognize my presence. They don't say hello. They don't even acknowledge my existence. And, you know, that's, you know, you think you get to a city and you're going to be social and meet friends and stuff, but people in cities are just generally less welcoming and less friendly to strangers. And that's not the case when you get into the countryside. Everybody wants to know who you are, curious about you, and you make friends and family. So, and, you know, in many of the countries I went to, being alone was a challenging thing to actually find time to your own. I mean, when you're actually traveling, you know, when I'm traveling during the day, I'm definitely alone on the bicycle or on the sailboat. But the second I stop, I would be surrounded by new friends. And even though I was exhausted, I would end up having conversations.
One of the big things that I think a lot of people do traveling for is trying new foods. What stop did you have where you thought that, like, this is like the best food I've ever had?
Oh, I mean, that's such a hard, hard thing to say. I mean, I love Indian food. I had eaten lots of Indian food before I went to India, and it was just lovely to have it easily accessible all the time and experience some new flavors as well. I think one of the more pleasant surprises was Malaysia and the food there. So they sort of have, they call it, I don't know, like the tricultural experience in India. So there's the Malays, the Chinese, and the Indians. They sort of make up the majority of the country. And so those three combinations of foods come together in a melting pot at times, or separate. They're all very delicious. Sometimes crazy spicy, but not all the time.
Let's run back to the return home. So you got into North America around Florida. So by then, it was this year.
That was this year, yes.
March 13th. So after, I guess at this point, 7 years, what was, I guess, the biggest adjustment or change you had to make coming back to North America?
Biggest change was by far the having to pay attention to how much things cost. I cannot afford to live in North America with my budget. My annual budget has been under $20,000. And so I spent, you know, more than a quarter of that in my first couple months, or my first month in the United States, just because the Canadian dollar exchange rate was really bad too. And so I didn't even notice that. And it's not like I'm throwing money away, but just buying food was enough to spend all my budget. And that was a shock for sure. Food prices have risen. Cost of living has risen, and that's the biggest change. Outside of that, it's been pretty normal.
Just very quickly, well, like, so you spent a lot of your money in the first couple of months of being back in North America. Let's compare that to India, because you stayed there, I guess, the longest. In terms of the cost of living, like how different is it compared to North America?
It's vastly different. I mean, I can survive on, if I wanted to, $5 a day in India, and that's eating three meals out and maybe even finding a place to stay. I mean, $5 is maybe pushing it. $10 comfortably, get a room and three meals. You know, in the States, that's you're lucky if you can do that for $200 now. It's a big difference.
So rounding back to the end of your journey, what was going through your mind during that final stretch of your massive walkathon?
One of my favorite things about traveling and living this dream is that I'm able to very easily drop into the present moment and just live by my instinct in the present. And that's like it's one of the reasons why I love to travel more than anything. I don't have to have stress about future plans or the past, and I can just wake up in the morning and decide to go one way or the other. It's a very sort of freeing, liberating sensation. As I approached the end of this journey, I was still able to maintain that sense of living in the present moment. And because of that, I didn't really have any expectations, or was dwelling on how I would feel or what I would do or like what it would be like to get to the end of the journey. I knew it was going to be extremely emotional seeing all my friends and family who I hadn't seen in 8 years. I didn't know how that emotion was going to express itself, and I didn't know how I was going to feel. But, you know, Saturday was sort of a blur. I felt very surreal. By the end of the day, my cheekbones were really sore from like smiling all the time, and it just didn't really feel real to me. It was a very bizarre feeling. Yeah, when the emotion did hit, I mean, the emotion had hit me before, even just when I crossed the border into Canada. I started crying at the border. I was at a loss of words, and yeah, it was wonderful. I said at the final party, for me, I had I'd always been thinking that the first step of this journey is way more important to me than the last step, because the ending and accomplishing this goal was, I had sort of accepted that that was less important than just living the goal and being in the moment in it. But at the same time, it was one of the most important moments of the whole journey, not because I finished the journey, but because I was with my loved ones and so many friends and family for the first time in so long. Like that made the end that much more important than any other time on the journey.
So before we finish off and we part ways, I want to round it back to my first starting question. What has been the biggest change for you since you started this journey?
About halfway through the journey, I was in Malaysia and I went to Vipassana Meditation Center, where you learn the technique that Buddha taught to his students. And it's a form of meditation that I never knew existed. And it was very suitable for the way I meditate. The only way you can learn it is by sitting and meditating silently for almost 10 days. Through that process, I was really able to let go of any concern for future and just really accept everything in my life. And so I'd say, knowing that, and I went back and did it again 8 months later, another 10-day silent meditation retreat. And knowing that this form of meditation exists, I feel like I have a retirement plan. I feel like I don't need anything at all in my life but to sit and meditate in order to be happy. And so I would say that is the biggest change that I've come, is I'm just way more accepting of everything. That's how I find true freedom right now.
That was journalist Owen Thompson talking to Marcus Bukonin about his 8-year trip around the world without using any motorized transportation. His voyage ended with a walk to Woodbine Beach in Toronto. After 8 years, he made it back home with only his body feeling older, says Bukonin.
You're on the air with Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Well, this is what concludes this episode of Viewpoints. National editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner, journalist Owen Thompson. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Stay tuned to what follows. See you next week.
I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.